I mean, the album may bring into play the idea of the barrier of the year 2000, but really it's about 1995. One of the things that Brian and I hope to do is to complete this cycle of albums, four or five of them, as a sort of a musical or textual diary for the last 5 years of the 90s. The subject matter may bring into play the year 2000, but the content is the texture of this year. Quite likely, because of the way Brian and I work, that the narrative might really fall by the wayside on the next album.
Hello, I'm Arslan Mohammed, and welcome to the much-delayed final instalment in our mega chat about David Bowie's 1995 epic, One Outside. This podcast can be listened to as it is, or if you like to do things in order after the previous two Outside episodes. But in the spirit of this fractured masterpiece, go ahead and listen to it in any order you like. That's what I say. So before we get onto our feature presentation, today I would just like to say that wherever you are, I hope you're well and staying safe. I will be posting more content in the days and weeks to come, and if this podcast gives you at least some amusement and distraction, I would be very happy indeed. So now join me and Nicholas Pegg as we dive into the weird, wild and wackadoodle world of One Outside.
Now, I remember George Harrison's 1981 album, Somewhere in England, and George Harrison's record label weren't getting on very well at the time.
Right.
Because George Harrison delivered quite a turgid, dull, worthy album. And they told him, look, you know, you're going to have to bugger off and write some tunes here, you know. Yeah. And of course, George Harrison, being bitter and grumpy and sardonic, came back with one of the most wonderfully sarcastic songs. It's called Blood from a Clone. And it's really, and it is just bollocking the record company for having the nerve to ask him to write some hits. You know, he's making all these very sarcastic, high-flown comments about it.
Yeah.
It can be quite funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Unintentionally, when that happens. So, yeah, I was wondering if that was the case of a record label sending Bowie back and saying, you know, come back to us when you've got something we can release.
Well, I think there was certainly an element of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. I mean, you know, one of the little byways of this that we haven't mentioned, we talked about how he'd been veering between the, you know, the mainstream and the obscure for the first half of the 90s. He'd also been, you know, careering from one record label to the next as well. You know, he'd been with EMI in the 80s. He famously signed with EMI for Let's Dance and was with them for the, you know, the rest of the 80s up to the first Tin Machine album. Mm-hmm. But then when the second Tin Machine album, when it got to that, EMI basically sort of refused point blank to put it out, I think. He went to another very small record label and did a deal with them at that point and released it on that London. And then they went out of business, I think, which is one of the reasons why the Tin Machine 2 album kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. You know,
it's not a good sign, is it?
Yeah. And then he was with Arista and BMG for Black Tie, White Noise. And then eventually, having sorted out Outside, he signed with Virgin in America and stayed with BMG. So he was kind of lurching from one record label to the next at this period. And of course, this whole period, he then stayed with Virgin stroke EMI up until Hours, you know. So, well, that's only another couple of albums after this, isn't it? But then, of course, as we talked about when we talked about Heathen, he then formed his own record label after all. But yeah, it is extraordinary looking back now to think that, you know, one of the world's foremost popular musicians was having that much trouble getting a record contract.
Exactly.
You know, it's incredible, really, isn't it?
And this is only 25 years ago.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was. I mean, we've touched on this before. It was a period where he wasn't necessarily loved. In the press.
That's right. That's right.
Despite the good reviews for this album.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this album did get good reviews. It sort of got a bit of a backlash in the wake of it. You know, when the tour came along, a few of the, you know, enemies and Melody Makers and those sort of ones did start sort of sneering at it a bit and saying, "Oh, it's a bit mad, actually, isn't it?" and things. But yeah, it did actually get very good reviews. But yeah, the bigger picture of this is definitely that Bowie was regarded as the sort of automatic reverence that I think he does now command these days was in short supply in the 1990s.
So. I mean, look at it now when we're releasing things like I sat through Dance the other day.
Oh yes, from
the remix album from the early 80s and.
Moving
on.
Indeed. Yes. So we're on to another segue, aren't we?
We're on to another segue, and this is the wonderfully named Algeria Touch Shriek. I always keep pronouncing it as Touch Screen.
Very prescient, David. Very good, yeah. This is the longest one of the segues, isn't it? Goes on. I think this is great. It's a lovely, delightful bit. It's got this wonderful kind of very Eno sort of almost lift music in the background, kind of cod reggae thing, which is very, very catchy. And yeah, Algeria Touch Shriek, he's a 78-year-old dealer in art, drugs, and DNA prints, we are told, in the accompanying text. Again, this is, you know, I was talking about Dickensian characters. He is, isn't he? He's almost like a sort of old, you know, he's looking out from his little shop.
That's how I imagine him, like a tiny little hunched, strange old man, hobbling around
a broken
little
man. Yeah. And he dreams of having another broken man to share his days with. He says something like, we could have great conversations looking through windows for demons and watching the young advancing all electric. I love that line. Yeah. That's just brilliant. Watching the young advancing all electric. It's like the antithesis of Bowie being an early adopter of the internet, isn't it? It's someone who's been left behind by the flow downstream of, you know, and it's a sort of, I imagine him being on, you know, very stubbly and just this sort of dirty, a sort of
very
steptoe, with his little woolen fingerless gloves on. Absolutely. I think we've got exactly the same image of him. Yeah,
we've
got him nailed. But there's a pathos to it, which is extraordinary, because it's a daft name. It's David Bowie putting on a silly voice against some reggae lift music, talking about the young advancing all electric. And there's something really quite moving, actually, in a bizarre way.
It is. I mean, what was interesting is you listen to this, and you know there are always wonderful apocryphal stories about Bowie and Eno doing Pete and Dud imitations during the Berlin session.
That's right. Yeah.
And this sounds a little bit like that, doesn't it? Yeah. It sounds a bit like Peter Cook's character.
Yes, it does. Yes, it's got
comes
that.
Out that.
Did you know? Yeah, exactly.
It would be intriguing to wonder if they were back to doing their Pete and Dud imitations in the 90s, and then Algeria Touch Shriek.
There's got to have been an element, hasn't there, of Eno sort of egging him on as he was recording these. I mean, we don't know because we weren't there, but I can't imagine that it wasn't largely, you know, there wasn't an element of just trying to make each other laugh a bit, you know.
I think there was definitely an element of that with all these characters, because all these segues where you have all the different characters, knowing his fondness for puns, for imitations, for wordplay, for just... Yeah. You know, that kind of banter that he would do with Eno.
Yes.
And Eno was a, you know, very willing participant in all that.
Very able foil
for him. And it's really interesting to think about how those bits must have originated in what sort of just random, bizarre conversations in character were taking place. And then they kind of somehow evolved into these segues.
Yes.
And definitely Algeria Touch Shriek is the favourite. My favourite of all the... You know,
oh, me
if,
too.
If we have a favourite of all the segues, then this... And I do love the hard-boiled gumshoe of Nathan Adler too.
Yeah.
But that's very much sort of character. Yeah. We'll come to that.
Yeah.
But, okay, Algeria Touch Shriek, he's our man.
I was at a Bowie gig. Oh, God, I'm trying to remember when this was. It was probably on the Heathen tour or something. You know the way in between songs people pointlessly shout out a song that they want him to play as if he's going to go, oh, all right, I'll play that, even though we haven't rehearsed it. You know, that thing that happens at gigs. And people normally will shout out a greatest hit. They'll shout out, you know, play Let's Dance. Yeah. Someone shouted out, play Segway Algeria Touch Tree. Well, that's good. That is quite cool, actually.
I think I would have done that, though. Do some more Touch Tree. Come on. Okay, so now we're getting on to another one of the singles.
No.
Was it not a single?
No, The Voyeur of Utter Destruction. Yeah. No, that wasn't a single.
No, it wasn't a single.
Could have been, though, couldn't it? It's another. No, that wasn't.
Maybe in my alternate universe.
Maybe in your alternate universe. No, this wasn't. So this is absolutely the new school of pretension, isn't it? Yeah. This is a preposterous title. The Voyeur of Utter Destruction... brackets as beauty. This is definitely Bowie, and, you know,
this is the tabloid version of David Bowie, isn't it?
Sort of like
this one-dimensional character which is just completely up his own arse. Just incredibly.
And of course, again, as we've said so many times, utterly intentional. Of course, it's you know that. And this is to be sung by the artist / Minotaur. bringing up the Minotaur. The Minotaur was a character that really interested Bowie at this point. A lot of his paintings were to do with the Minotaur. That featured quite heavily in his own exhibition of work that he put on in 95. He was obviously fascinated by that. And again, there's a kind of a Damien Hirst thing about the Minotaur, isn't there? It's obviously a man with a bull's head. Yeah. And so you could sort of almost imagine that being some kind of Damien Hirst installation. In fact, I think, I don't know how apocryphal this is, but I'm sure... Either Damien Hirst or Bowie, I forget who said it in some interviews, actually at some point around about this, we were actually talking about, wow, you could even buy a Greek island and install and build a labyrinth and actually have a human body with a bull's head if we could find someone to donate their body after death, and that could actually be like the ultimate installation. But I don't know if that was a piece... I mean, obviously, that was probably just, you know, down the pub one night. They thought that would be a laugh. I don't think they were ever planning to do it. But that's the ultimate in conceptual art, isn't it? Anyway, so the murderer... artist person in this story, if story it be, is apparently a Minotaur on some level or another, maybe not literally. The Voyeur of Utter Destruction, fantastic number. I can easily believe that you thought it was a single, because it does have it's weird as heck, but it does have that sort of commercial sheen. It harks back to Lodger for me. It's got that same kind of speed funk, is that a phrase, the sort of thing it you get now. On Look Back in Anger or Red Sails. Again, Carlos Alomar, much in evidence, kind of whirling away on guitar. We've once again got that sort of cyclical time theme coming, haven't we? The sort of mantra at the beginning is turn and turn again, that sort of thing, which is... already had that time again. The wheels are turning in Oxford Town as well, in that song, you know. It's a weird one. This it was a great. It was a favoured live number of his on the outside tour. He did do it on TV shows. He did the White Room and Jules Holland and those sort of shows. This is one that he pulled out
because it's a great ensemble piece, isn't it?
Yeah, you know,
it's a fantastic band performance.
But again, quite a sort of confrontational one because it's not the easiest way in, but it's great. And it's also again weird lyrics. I shake. For the reeking flesh is as romantic as hell.
this is one generated by his software.
Certainly there was an element of that with this one. Yes. It's great. I'm not sure what else to say about it. Really, it's a wonderful kind of speeding number that really sort of carries you along. There's it's simultaneously dark and almost quite uplifting. Actually, it's there is a darkness that keeps coming in. So just really, it's the music and the lyrics are almost in conflict with each other, isn't it? Because yes, call it a day is the kind of play out phrase, isn't it?
But then, like you say, it has that very propulsive feel to it that you find in Lodger or something.
Yeah.
And again, it's that tension between it's that dissonance between the lyric and the music that creates something that is so compelling and so enjoyable and just. Great to get your teeth into and really enjoy it.
Absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
Wasn't a single. That's what I think.
Could have been a single. Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So propelling onwards. We now, that one, looking at this, that's the only song that has segues either side of it.
Is it?
Yes, because now we have Ramona A. Stone.
Right, we have Ramona A. Stone, yes, who's another one.
What do you make of Ramona A. Stone?
I think this is possibly the most bonkers of all the segues. We're agreed that we love Touch Shriek, but yeah, this is such a sort of heavily treated voice, this kind of almost alien-sounding...
It is incredibly disorientating.
Yeah, and this is Bowie. Again, I think he's having a wonderful time doing this. Ramona A. Stone, apparently she makes jewellery out of body parts. Mm-hmm. And... there's something very... I think he's really tipping the wink to us here. Bowie was as aware as anybody else, more aware than anybody else, of the situation into which his career had found itself, you know, in the late 80s and into the thing. And he is still kind of working out how to get himself out of that rut at this point. And this sort of thing is, you know, clearly is the emergence from that rut. And Ramona A. Stone says, I was an artiste... in a tunnel, and I've been having a midi life crisis. That's what she says. Now, midi life is obviously a little, that's a pun. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, one can't ignore the fact that David Bowie, on his album, okay, he's playing someone else, but he's just said, I was an artiste in a tunnel and I've been having a midlife crisis. Now, you know, he's dressed it up in another character and in a silly voice, but it almost feels like it could be a confession, doesn't it? You know,
it does.
Shut himself in a tunnel.
You need to have that necessary layer You need that insulating layer between reality and art. And then here he is, straddling that. With
yes.
That was me. With midlife crisis. It's almost mocking. It's not mocking, but it's, you know, there's certainly a snarking.
Oh, yes. Snarking. And it is a very snark. The way he does the character is very snarky.
The character is a snark.
It's very... Barnaby, my partner, we were listening to this album yesterday in the car as we drove here, and he remarked, he said, sounds a bit like Lindsay Kemp. Sounds really? Like he's doing it, because he's got that sort of camp voice. And I thought, I've never thought of that before. I don't think it's a direct impersonation of Lindsay Kemp, but it does have an element of that.
Right,
it's got, because Lindsay was a wonderfully flamboyant sort of, and he was an artiste, no question about it, you know. So, yeah, you listen to that segue again and think Lindsay. I think that he might have been onto something there. I think that's rather... she says in this, one of the lines she says in this segue is we'll creep together, you and I, and that's another recurring thing that was in the old original sessions recordings, the stuff that got leaked. This is a phrase, we'll creep together, that comes up. There's actually a song which we don't actually know the official, if Bowie had ever given it a title, what the title would have been, but it's become known as we'll creep together because it seems, you know, that's what he sings with it. So there's a whole track kind of on that, but it's along with the Laugh Hotel and various other things, it's just a phrase that keeps turning up again and again throughout the thing. So again, this is one of the things that's sort of lost on the final album, is this idea of this sort of repetitious coming back in a different way to something that we've already heard, and so that's a little remnant of that. And going into the next track, I Am With Name, which this segues straight into, I Am With Name, very much, you know, this is kind of perhaps the closest taste on the album of what the original Leon album would have been like, is this sort of atmospheric, sort of ambient atmosphere piece, you know, with vocal interjections from the different characters popping through and echoing through. There are various different, I think we hear Ramona and we hear Nathan Adler and we hear a sort of crowd of people at one point, and Bowie just intoning things like Anxiety Descending and things like that. And there's a 10-minute long version of this, effectively, on the leaked version. It's again, I love it. It's great. It's very, it's one of the least commercial pieces on the whole thing, really, isn't it? But sounds great. I think it sounds great. Wonderful percussion and wonderful bass. You know, it's just this sort of, it's very Eno, I think.
As we said just now, all these segues do have Eno all over them. You know, that I think from concept upwards, Eno is there all over them, and I think that's his most visible presence on the album. I mean, obviously he's there forming the textures, forming the layers, and working with Bowie in the background. But this to me is his thumbprints. Other segues.
Absolutely. So that's it. Yeah. So and interesting that on the track listing, the way that it's sort of written out on the album is this is the one thing that goes segue, and then it goes slash I Am With Name, as if that's part of the same segue, which it kind of is. So I Am With Name is almost an instrumental, if that it doesn't really make sense. But yeah, it's kind of some more of the segue music with Ramona sort of just reappearing occasionally.
Yes.
Well,
Ramona is definitely the most disturbing of the segues. I mean, Algeria Touchstreak is surreal and dark, and Nathan Adler, who I'm really looking forward to talking about. Okay, Wishful Beginnings.
Oh, now this is a terrifying one, isn't it?
This is scary.
This is again to be sung by the artist stroke Minotaur. We're back in darkest Scott Walker territory again, aren't we? It's a kind of this nightmare rhythm track, utterly minimalist, just bass, drum, bit of tambourine. And then a sort of distorted vocal patch doing that sort of vocal fry sort of thing. And that's the kind of backing over which Bowie is presumably the murderer crooning to his victim.
It has that to it, doesn't it? Sort of that sort of...
Sort of kind of... It's terrible. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah.
And yes, the sorry little girl he keeps singing, the pain must feel like snow, is an extraordinary line. Dark. I think dark is the word for this.
dark is definitely the word for it. But that there is a history of these kind of poems and ballads and stories of a murderer talking to his victim. I mean, please, Mr. Gravedigger.
Indeed,
is another example of, you know, the narrator turning out to be, you know, a very very sinister individual who's just something very bad, and. But the ballad form as well. I mean, you know, even look at something like Kylie and Nick Cave, Where the Wild Roses Grow, or old blues songs, In the Pines. You know, this history and tradition of the murderer talking to it, to his or her deceased victim. I love that. I really love that. It's so atmospheric, and this really doesn't disappoint. It has that perfect blackness to it.
Yeah, it is. It's an extraordinary number. It's one of the more obscure ones on the album, I suppose. He didn't do it live ever, and it actually had the, you know, ignominy, sadly and unfairly, of being cut from one of the reissue versions of the album. After the album came out, there were various alt versions that came out. Of course, this was the CD age. That was when things, you know, vinyl was becoming a bit obsolete. So there was a vinyl version, but it was a single album, and it was called Excerpts from One Outside and had bits missing off it. But then there was also, about a year later or so, this One Outside version 2 came out, and they had rather ruthlessly taken Wishful Beginnings off and put on the Pet Shop Boys remix instead of Hello Space Boy, which was a bit sad. Didn't deserve that. It's one of the great tracks on the album.
Then the title, Wishful Beginnings.
Yeah, that's a... There's quite a bit to unpick there, isn't there? Yes. Well, he sings, we had such wishful beginnings, didn't he? That's what they, you know, as if it's all gone wrong. It wasn't meant to end up this way. And again, is this him thinking about the millennium? Is this him thinking about we had such optimism? Of course, he's also thinking about this murder. I mean, goodness knows. It's intriguing, isn't it? He was always the master of the intriguing title, wasn't he? And sometimes a title, you know, some of his titles can be are very straight down the line, obviously just the sort of character in the song, like the Gene Genie or Rebel Rebel or something like that. But sometimes he'll choose a line from the lyric, or not even from the lyric, that just, you think, why is it, why is that the title? That's intriguing. And yeah, Wishful Beginnings is one of those, isn't it?
It's wishful. It's not a word you really come across every day, is it? No. I was quite taken by the word, wishful. Yeah.
This album's full of weird.
Yes.
Very cab, isn't it? There's a wonderful... passivity is a word that's in one of the lyrics.
Not many songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Not many songs come up with passivity.
Yeah.
But you mentioned earlier these, you know, that the history of those sort of 18th century, 19th century, murder, potboilers and things. And again...
We were talking about murder and the way that it was, you know, marketed, basically.
Yes, yes.
But
again, wishful would be, you know, there's a sort of Penny Dreadful feel to it. I think when I heard this, I was just struck by the choice of that word.
Yes.
And then the choice of that title, given the theme of the lyric and the sort of dread all around it.
Yes.
Yeah, a really wonderful combination.
Yeah. And beginnings is actually, wishful beginnings. It's almost like the opposite end of happy endings, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
If you see what I mean. It's
wishful kind of beginnings.
Exactly. It's dark. It's like, what's that Ian McCulloch song called? The Back of Love, isn't it? Is that right? Yeah.
I'm not really familiar with Ian McCulloch's.
Never put love in a song title, but he came up with the Back of Love. That's. I hope I've got that right. That is Ian McCulloch, isn't it? Otherwise,
I'll check with Mr. Google.
I think it's an Echo of the Bunny Man. Anyway, it's wishful beginnings. It sort of poses more questions than it answers, doesn't it? Wonderful. I love it. Am I just saying this about every single track on this album?
You are.
It's another great one. It's a great album.
Come on, Nick, there must be a song on this album that you don't like.
I don't think there is.
Come on.
Sorry.
Really?
I love the next one. I don't think there is. I'm just looking down the list. No. Mm-hmm. None of them.
We're entering the home stretch now.
There are... I may have a few negative points to make, a few minor ones at some point, but no, I love them all.
Okay. Yeah. So we're entering the home stretch now.
Yeah.
And this really, I think, you know, if you've reached this far in the album, actually for that matter, if you've reached this far in the podcast, I applaud you.
then we apologise. Yeah.
We apologise.
Well, We Prick You is a really interesting one. To be sung by members of the Court of Justice, incidentally. Mm-hmm. And it's got that chorus going, tell the truth. And it's another one from the January 95 sessions. Very strange piece. Carlos Alomar, again, you can hear him at work on it. The working title of this one was Robot Funk, which is interesting. It just kind of describes the backing track in a way, doesn't it? Because it's got these very sort of bleepy, sort of very Eno-y sort of noises. I think you can start to hear Bowie beginning to dabble in... maybe not actually drum and bass styles here, but it has got a kind of proto-Earthling feel to it, this track. It's almost, you know, we've said before, there's always at least one track on every Bowie album that's the kind of shape of things. I actually think on this album, the one that most points the way to Earthling is yet to come. It's the next one. It's I'm Deranged. I think that's the sort of it. But this one has got a little bit of that as well. Once again, we've got apocalyptic angst. You know, that it's part Diamond Dogs jump in a river holding hands, part Prince party like it's 1999. It's got that kind of feel to it. There's a wonderful, wonderful line. Want to be screwing when the nightmare comes. Want to come quick, then die. There's a line to conjure with. It's also got this weird little patch. It's actually Bowie impersonating Camille Paglia, the noted cultural commentator. It's got this little voice going, you show respect, even if you disagree, which comes up over and over again in the track. Right. Now, this was... Bowie wanted to use it. It was an extract from something she'd said in an interview or something. I think it was in some chat show or something, and she'd just snapped at someone else saying, you show respect, even if you disagree. Mm. And he wanted to use it because he thought it was great. And so he got his people to get in touch with her people, sort of thing. And according to Bowie, the story was that they kept getting messages back saying, sorry, is this really David Bowie? And if it is it important? What's going on? And
eventually, what does David Bowie want?
And he gave up in the end and just, yes, I'll record it myself. So it's actually Bowie's voice doing it, impersonating Camille Paglia.
Why do you think he was so taken by that?
I don't know. It's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Something that just floated out of the ether and just...
Yeah, you know, goodness knows why it sort of lodged itself in his head, but it was obviously what he wanted. It's got a wonderful rhythmic quality to it. And, you know, Bowie often, you know, the rhythm and the sound of words is as important as their actual sort of dictionary meaning.
Course,
you know, the part of the context is the sort of... And it does actually, with the sort of very rackety fast rhythm of the thing, it fits perfectly, you know. It's a weird old song. And again, it's quite catchy. It's got this wonderful kind of wonky bass line, which is very very catchy. Another great one live on that tour. Actually, funny story about that. There's a line in it, where have all the flowers gone? Okay, yes. At one point, where have all the flowers gone? As the tour went round, I'm not sure when this started, but certainly by the time it was in the UK, there was a dedicated bunch of Bowie fans who would... I never know how these guys do it, but they get the front middle row tickets every single time.
Right, you
know,
yes. Was it a fan club or something?
And, there are various sort of very hardcore people who do this, and it's fantastic, you know. I've actually since met one of these people, and I know her quite well now. Hello, Charlie, if you're listening. I know she was involved in this. I don't know if she was the ringleader of this, but anyway, when he got to the line, where have all the flowers gone, at some gig or other, a couple of them chucked some flowers on stage on that line.
Nice.
And then this rapidly escalated over the next course of the next, because they were going to every single concert.
Yeah.
And within, you know, a few days of that, Bowie was getting to the line and then kind of ducking as this giant sort of avalanche of flowers hit the stage every single time on this line. So well done, Charlie. That's great. I didn't know these people at the time. When I saw that tour, I wasn't in the front row. I was a bit further back, but I saw it happening. I saw the flowers flying up. That was great.
I love the idea of this huge mountain of flowers.
Marvelous. I love the fact that he kind of knew about it and was ducking from the... But isn't that wonderful that on a song as obscure as this, that sort of audience participation was happening? It wasn't just someone throwing some red shoes because it was Let's Dance. It was on a, you know, one of the most obscure songs.
Just
even
one
on
line
this
in
album.
The song, and we know what to do.
I think that's actually rather marvellous. I should imagine he loved it. I should admit he was delighted that the song had, you know, been noticed enough for that to happen, you know. A great track, a blooming weird track, but yeah, great one.
Any more thoughts on this one? Or?
Nope. Plenty, but no. It's another entry in that sort of pre-millennial impending doom. It is quite Diamond Dogs-y, that one. It's got a particular Diamond Dogs feel to it.
Diamond Dogs and Outside. So Diamond Dogs was a fictional story set in this sort of Gotham style city of dread and darkness and everything. Obviously the Orwell influence was there.
Yeah.
And Outside is it has hints of that. It's kind of for real. The millennium's there. It's coming. This is it. And he sounds so excited.
Yeah.
We're all going to hell in a handcart. Yeah. It's terrible. But it's a way of all those tensions that we keep coming back to throughout the career, and you've said this time and again on this podcast, coming to the fore and frothing up in one big explosion of immediacy and relevance. Now, these things I've been discussing all my career, now they're here.
Yeah.
Now that it's really happening, where are we going? Look, we've got this big thing coming up. We're all going to die. We're not going to die. What's going to happen? And it was almost like a wall that he was up against.
Yes.
And it inspired these songs.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Right. Oh, so your favourite character has finally arrived.
Okay, so now it's Nathan Adler.
Which is segue Nathan Adler, yeah. Yeah, he's a kind of... well, he's sort of dime novel private eye, isn't he? Straight out of a sort of... He's played by Humphrey Bogart, isn't he?
Yes, exactly.
In a film noir.
And it's very, very... it's kind of like out of the side of his mouth and tough talking.
Yeah, boy like, doing that kind of voice. He says, if she... Cutting a zero in the fabric of time itself, or something like that.
Cutting a zero in the fabric of time.
Yeah.
My favourite one, which a friend of mine, Kit, told me was she walked in and she had a face which would make a priest kick out a stained glass window.
Which is very awesome. Good. Yeah.
I've always enjoyed that. So, someone should compile a list of these sometime. So, Nathan Adler, now he's. He's the detective, isn't he? He's the gumshoe detective trying to piece together. The murder of Baby Grace. And it's quite late in the day that we're hearing it.
Yes, that we hear his voice. His voice does appear in the background of a few earlier bits in I Am With Name and things like that. But yeah, this is the first time we actually get to hear from him. And he is also supposedly the author of the sleeve notes, the diary of Nathan Adler. The multi-page crazy thing that appears in the packaging. And it's well worth a read because it, again, illuminates what was going on in Bowie's mind about this... It fills in the world a bit. And it talks about art a lot. It talks about real artists and fictional artists, but, very extreme sort of people. It mentions Chris Burden, by the way. That's the guy who's from... Nail Me to My Car and I'll Tell You Who You Are from Joe the Lion. And he also talks about... there's Ron Athey, who was an HIV positive artist in New York, Four Scenes in a Harsh Life was one of his pieces of work, involved impaling himself with knitting needles and then carving patterns into a fellow performer's back before hanging blotting paper prints from that over the heads of the audience and this sort of thing, really quite extreme stuff. And this is all kind of referenced in the sleeve notes, and then he talks about it and he kind of brings it all in because he's not just a detective from the police, he's a detective from the art crime department of the Art Crime Inc.
It's not just your regular plot, is it?
No, this
is,
absolutely, yeah. So art crime is a specific
crime division. Yeah.
And I think, hasn't Ramona been arraigned for plagiarism without a licence or something like that? Well, that's brilliant. Plagiarism without a licence. Like, some people are allowed to plagiarise and some people aren't. That's fantastic. Again, so perceptive of the way creative art has gone now, sampling and whatever. We're still in quite early days of that, the whole kind of, and Napster and whatever it might be. All of that lay in the future, So that's all quite interesting. Yeah, and... So yeah, he's clearly not just some sort of gumshoe who doesn't know anything. He kind of knows all about art and he references it all and
And that's the art part of the murder.
Yes.
So it's kind of articulating the art part of the murder.
Yes. This murder is clearly artistic enough that we've had to call in Art Crime Inc. Extraordinary really, isn't it?
So that's Nathan Adler.
And
then we move on to I'm Deranged.
Again, to be sung by the artist stroke Minotaur.
And again, it's like you said just now, it's one of the tracks which could be said to be a sort of flagging up what's coming
next. Yeah, I think this is sort of the shape of things to come, isn't it? This is the one that, to me anyway, sounds the most like it could just as happily belong on Earthling.
Well, he played it. On the Earthling tour,
he played around with this one a lot sort of developed it on in the Earthling style, absolutely, and it was quite a big part of the Earthling tour sort of ethos. But oddly, it also has that kind of commercial club sheen that you hear on the work he was doing with Nile Rodgers earlier in the decade. It sounds very sort of clubby. It sounds a little bit like something like. Jump They Say or something like that. I don't mean the same tune or anything.
No, but it has that feel to it.
It's got that sort of... And again, Carlos on the guitar just giving it that quite sort of commercially feel. But it's another quite tricky piece. It doesn't open its arms and welcome you in. It's quite strange and cold. Again, very much a cut-up, randomised lyric. Actually reminds me of The Wasteland a bit. It's got this... I think a bit... Well, he keeps... Salam keeps happening in it, which is a bit like the shanty thing in The Wasteland. I don't know, I've jotted a bit down here. How does it go? And the rain sets in. It's the angel man. I'm deranged. Big deal, salam. Be real deranged, salam. I mean, that's been well and truly chewed by his computer, hasn't
it's
it?
It's totally been chewed by the computer, I think it's. Yeah. And then probably cut up as well for good measure.
Yeah.
But again, it's the feel of the piece. It's the feel of the song, which is just... I remember this kind of woke me up from my sort of drifting away with a bit of a slap in the face, you know, just because it's, you know, it has that wonderful energy to it.
Yeah.
And it's... You can see why this one went on to become such a big, you know,
a
vehicle for him to sort of graft on different styles, like more jungle styles and more techno styles in the coming
years. And it does. It sounds quite jungly. It just sounds quite clubby. You could put that on in a club and expect people to dance. Maybe not all of them, but some of them,
How did it fit into the overall narrative? You know, the Nathan Adler narrative. I mean, how do you see it fitting in there?
Gosh, now you're asking. I'm not sure if it really does fit into the narrative in any meaningful way. I mean, you know, as we've said already, you know, many times that, you know, that's not necessarily the way that we have to look at this. And Bowie himself said, you know, very soon after the album came out, he actually said, look, you don't have to, you know, I've kind of already left all that behind. It's just bits and pieces for you to make with.
So this is, in other words, a classic example of how not to approach it as part of being a linear narrative rather than seeing it...
Bearing in mind, the ultra-pretentious overall title of the album is about the non-linear gothic hypercycle.
Exactly. There we go, which is flagging it up for you.
Through These Architects' Eyes,
through
isn't it?
These Architects' Eyes. Now, in the middle of all the murder and the mayhem and the dismemberment and the bodies and everything, we have architecture.
Yes, this
is
extraordinary.
Which is quite,
isn't it?
You know, Richard Rodgers.
Yeah.
Well,
again, this is another late edition. This is from the New York sessions at the end of the whole process, really. But yeah, you're right. It's a bit of a blind side. They're just coming out of nowhere. So, I mean, how like David Bowie to do a rock song about modern architecture? You know,
absolutely.
I mean, there aren't many who would go down that route and manage to make it. You know, this is a song that name checks Richard Rodgers and Philip Johnson, he's singing all the majesty of the city landscape and these sort of lines, and it's like so much of this album, it could so easily be ridiculous, but instead it is sort of kind of thrilling. I find it a very uplifting sort of. It's got this wonderful. It's partly music, of course. It's got this very sort of swaggering, sort of grandiose sort of atmosphere, hasn't it? And it's unlike a lot of the songs on this album. It's in a major key and it's quite rousing and. It's the beginning of a sort of uplift, I think, towards the end of the album.
Mm-hmm.
Unexpectedly, against all expectations, this album ends on a feeling of almost of sort of resolution, it does leave us feeling quite happy and satisfied, I think, at the end, compared to, you know, if he'd ended on Wishful Beginnings or The Heart's Filthy Lesson or something.
I would have thought Wishful Beginnings would have been a way to end.
Oh, certainly would have been a way
to end.
But
again, like we keep reiterating here, this is a non-linear narrative.
Right,
so these elements can all be shuffled and jumbled around.
Yes.
But it is interesting to contrast that, I mean, it is emphasised that it's a town.
Yes.
Oxford town. I've not been to Oxford town. Yet here we are with these big architects of the cities. You know, Richard Rodgers and Philip Johnson, who had made big, big works. And here he is in this song, like you say, in a major key, and he's walking along in these landscapes. Something's very much shifted here.
Yes.
This is a very different now, a very different narrative.
That's right. I mean, I think you would be hard-pressed if you wanted to go about, slotting this into some sort of coherent storyline about the murder thing. This is the one where you'd really struggle to work out what this has got to do with anything, really.
You would.
I think this is
What's
just
What's your
very,
take on that, though?
Oh, I mean, you know, and it can do, of course. It's, because it's a very urban album, isn't it? It's a very city sort of album.
Is it though?
I think so.
Really?
It's not necessarily all about skyscrapers and things, but I think it's certainly in a city stroke town environment. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't see Oxford Town as being a sleepy little hamlet with leafy suburbs. Mm. Maybe it is, though. I don't know.
That was my feeling. But I thought by the fact he could have just said, I've not been to Oxford, in which case the implication is a city.
Indeed.
But by saying Oxford Town, which is a sort of like, especially in that old folkloric way of referring to Oxford, Oxford Town.
Yes, sure.
Which is a, you know, it implies a narrowing, a smaller,
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, of course, this only goes to show that these things can conjure up different pictures in different people's heads. You could be right. I mean, it could be the Oxford Town thing could be far more rural. It could be more of a Twin Peaks, South Park sort of South Park. Yeah. There's a thought.
But again, there's really no single narrative. There's no right or wrong interpretation. I think that's one. I think this proves the ambiguities which are central to this album.
Yes,
can conjure up such varying, mental images and perceptions of it, obviously all equally valid.
Yeah, and although this might, sound like a much more conventional sort of song than some of the others on the album, it still evidently was done in the spirit of experimentation. Kevin Armstrong tells a quite interesting story about this one, actually. This was the first thing he did on the album. It's the first, apparently within 5 minutes of meeting Brian Eno on the first day, he was working on this song, and they just, in a very Lodger sort of way, we remember stories about Adrian Belew telling similar stories about Lodger. Yeah. They, got him to plug his guitar in, didn't play him the track at all, and then just put it on and said, go on, play along to this. And he did. And live, while he was doing it,
Eno was
manipulating the guitar sound with a multi-harmonizer, as it was coming out of the amp, it was already being... And so Kevin Armstrong...
like Fripp on... Lodger.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Sort of thing. Exactly that. Adrian Belew on Lodger. Yeah, Fripp on Scary Monsters. Yeah. But yeah, as Kevin Armstrong sort of said, they were obviously they wanted to capture that moment, the moment of him discovering it, on tape, and not have anything more rehearsed than that, not have anything more sort of studied or considered than that. But at the same time, to sort of manipulate it live as well. Mm. That's quite well, and that's that kind of that slightly phasey sort of guitar that chugs through it, which is rather fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was done literally on the first take.
Yeah,
that was
apparently
just his live playing,
Which is rather amazing. It's good. Yeah. It's a great track. It's got a wonderful sort of sort of slightly epic sort of feel. Slightly epic.
Damning it with faint praise. Contradiction
in terms. It's a little bit epic.
Just a little bit epic.
It is. It is quite... it's a goodie. It's another goodie. Yeah. But then we've got another, Nathan Adler segue.
Back to Nathan Adler. And what's happening in this one?
This is the Ramona Was So Cold one, isn't it? I don't know. What's happening in this one? He's... It's funny, I'll tell you what I think is funny, is that it almost feels that the album has left that whole thing behind now, and then suddenly we get another bit of Nathan Adler, because as we just said, the previous song was is a tough one to even try and fit into this narrative, but the next one, even harder, which is the final track on the album.
Up pops Nathan again.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't know, what do you think?
I think it's a retrospective, I'm guessing a retrospective decision to insert Nathan Adler in here, but do you feel that there's any sort of, because this is... On the original iteration of the album, this is the last we hear now of Nathan and the characters. Do you feel there's any sense of an ending or any sense of a resolution in this little segment at the end?
Not really.
No. There isn't.
It's
left quite open-ended.
It
could be anything.
One way that one might interpret the non-linear in the title, the non-linear Gothic hypercycle, is, of course, this is... as we've said, this is an album of the CD age. You could put it on random.
You could indeed.
And just play the album and see what comes out in what order, And I think Bowie would quite have enjoyed the idea of us all doing that. I've never actually done that.
Have you not?
It might be quite a fun thing to do.
I think that would be a fun thing to do, actually. Just putting that on random.
Yeah.
Seeing what happens. I mean, that's the perfect non-linear
approach
you can take. And like you say, an album which was devised in the CD, firmly in the CD age.
Yeah.
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 That's worth trying and do that.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just looking at the
booklet. Leaf through the booklet there.
Oh, Kreuzberg, Berlin. That's
Now,
that is from his original diary. So I remember reading this somewhere. It's 2 a.m. I can't sleep for the screaming of some poor ostracized Turkish immigrant screaming his guts out from the street. His hawking shriek sounds semi-stifled, like he's got a pillow over his mouth. I remember reading that definitely from his... He's brought that up before. Right, moving on to the finale, the final song.
The final song.
This is one which I know mainly from Buddha of Suburbia.
Right, because this is a re-recording of a song from the Buddha of Suburbia, his previous album in 1993. This version is a bit more sort of lush and a bit more multi-layered, yeah. You know, we've got Mike Garson's piano twinkling away and so on. So it's a bit more of a production number. The Buddha of Suburbia was quite a pared-down mm-hmm. album, as we've said. And this was the second single from Outside, right. UK number 39, for Fact fans. And it's odd, isn't it? It's a very odd decision. After all this extraordinary, uncompromising, crazy music. I mean, this was one of the more conventional tracks on the Buddha album. And yeah. The same goes here with Knobs On, you know. I mean, it's almost a bit like, coming at the end of the album, it's almost a bit like Bowie saying, oh, you wanted a pop song? Sure, yeah, no problem, here's one.
God, shit, Brian, we forgot the pop song. Quit sticking on at the end there.
It's a real oddity, positioned at the end of the album. It's a bit, I mean, in a way, a bit like The Secret Life of Arabia at the end of Heroes. Yeah, yeah. You know, in an alternative universe, Heroes could have ended on a much bleaker note with the end of Neukölln, and that's saxophone just going, at the end of album. But no, he puts the pop song at the end, the poppiest number on Heroes. The one that you could actually almost go, oops, upside your head along to, you know. You can, honestly, try it. You can do it. It's got exactly the same. Anyway.
I want to invite listeners everywhere to send in their audio samples singing oops, upside your head to The Secret Life of Arabia.
Yeah. So anyway, moving back to this one. Sorry, that's sacrilege. I'm so sorry, David. But Outside, ending with this, I mean, I can never decide whether it's a bit of a cop-out or whether it's actually a sort of subversive triumph, you know? It's almost like there's something very resolving about it. It's got a very sort of, it's quite a soothing, it's a lovely pop song, by the way. It's a really lovely song. Yeah. But it almost feels like it's what you'd roll the end credits over, almost. You know what I mean?
It could very well be that. It could very well be, you know, now the nightmare is over, now the film is done, and here come the credits, and here's a lovely, wonderful, charming, high-energy pop song. But why did he go back to Buddha and pick up this song
interesting,
and then bring
isn't
it over here?
I'm sure that there was a part of him that just thought, well, that's a nice song that didn't get heard much, because Buddha was, commercially, was an absolute disaster. It got marketed very badly, and it, you know, a lot of people didn't hear it at all. And it's got some fantastic stuff on it. It's a brilliant, brilliant album. And that song was obviously one that Bowie, you know, particularly thought, maybe that's just worth another hearing, so I'll re-record it and stick it on my next one. And the fact that he released it as a single from
really
Outside
did.
Means he obviously thought it was worth it. You know, he was obviously fond of it.
And it's got a lot of, there's a lot going on here. I mean, you've got that, is it the almost like a Spencer Davis group.
Oh, totally. Yeah. A song which he had already referenced once before, many, many, many years ago in his career. At the very time, it's Give Me Some Loving, isn't it? Spencer Davis group. When that was topping the charts in 1966, in the I went and looked up the dates when I was writing my book to check. He was, that very week, was recording Join the Gang from his first album.
Yes.
And that's got the, in this, whichever verse begins with, it goes, this club's called The Web, it's this month's pick, and boom, is what the bass line does at that point.
Of course.
Surely a direct reference to what was number one that week, because that is a song all about the transience of,
that's just,
you know.
Yeah, it's a little quote, isn't it?
Yeah, but so fantastic little gag. So anyway, many, many years later, he comes back to it. Yeah, no, there it's definitely.
Who'd have thought you could link up Join the Gang to Outside?
To Outside, there you go.
It's done.
And the lyrics are a sort of, as I have always understood them, but these are things that are always up for grabs. It seems to me to be a rather sort of, what do you call it? A sort of middle-aged love song in a way, a quite comfy love song. The sort of thing that ABBA were doing on their last album. There's a song they did called When All Is Said and Done, which is, got that same kind of, we've seen a few things, but we managed to pull through it one way or another, and,
that song, which I remember it used to amaze me when I was a kid, something like, now even sex is better.
Not too old for sex.
Imagine being 8 years old with your mates having sex. Strangers When We Meet. Now, having encountered the song for the first time through the prism of Buddha of Suburbia, being a huge fan of the book, it's funny because he's quoting bits and bobs from the actual book itself.
Yes.
So, like, I'm in clover. And there's a wonderful line in the book where Karim is talking about his dad when they would sit in his very bourgeois uncle and auntie's car, which still had like an Austin Allegro or something, which still had the plastic on the seats and was very, you know, they weren't allowed to touch anything. And Karim would say, hey, aren't we in the clover in this car, Karim?
Yeah.
He sings it, I am incredible. And then yeah. Head, heel, head over.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
Well, I think that is when all is said and done. But otherwise, we could just go on here for a long time.
But wonderful album. I'd say, you know, I'm so glad I saw that tour live on several occasions, because it was an amazing tour, which really brought the album to life for me as well. You know, because if I did say something negative, if I did have any criticism about the album, is that maybe that the production is from that very digital period when everything, you know, and I do find the sound of the album a little bit thin. Same sort of criticism that many people have raised, not least Kate Bush herself, about Kate Bush's album The Red Shoes that came out a year or two before. She went back and sort of analogued it up later on to make it sound warmer.
That didn't have much punch to it.
Yeah, and I do find that slightly with this album as well. I sort of wish it had a bit more sort of weight in its belly, you know, if you know what I mean. But that's all I can come up with. I love I love it. And if you turn it up loud enough and turn the bass up enough, then that does the trick, you know.
Mixed for CD, but do you know, that's interesting you say that. When I was researching this, I found this quote from Eno talking immediately after Bowie's death was announced. About a year ago, we started talking about Outside, the last album we worked on together. We both liked that album a lot and felt it had fallen through the cracks. And we talked about revisiting it, taking it somewhere new. I was looking forward to that.
Yeah, interesting.
How that might have panned out. Yeah. You know, to revisit it and maybe sort of start delving through all that extraneous material that was generated.
So much of it.
Coming up with a new mix of it or something, which, I mean, if they were talking about this in 2015, then who knows what they could have made of it.
Who knows, There's fascinating stuff. I mean, you know, it was always, at the time, I can remember feeling a little disappointed that, you know, I was aware there was all this other material and this idea that it might come, and it never did. But in another way, you know, as with every time with Bowie, it's the same, isn't it? That it's actually, it was ultimately always a good and healthy thing, that what happened instead was that he got interested in something else and moved on and did the next thing. And, you know, in this case, what it was that he took Outside out on tour with this absolutely cracking band, brilliant band, which was then thinned down a little bit in 96 to a slightly tighter band, and that became the core band. This was Reeves Gabrels, Zachary Ilford, Gail Ann Dorsey, a couple of other people, which became the band, and he enjoyed playing live with them so much, you know, they did the summer festivals and things in 96, that he took them back into the studio and they recorded what became Earthling, you know, and because what he was then enthused about was working with this fantastic band that he got on with so well and clearly loved their work, and so that was what it became, and quite right too, you know, that was always the great thing about Bowie, was that he sort of, you know, from one moment to the next, he got enthused about the next thing, and he was always looking forwards, not backwards, but you know, in the process of doing that, what he also managed to do was leave behind him this trail of amazing stuff, of which this amazing album is. Well, I mean, so as I've said, you know, I think it's his best album of the 90s. I love all the others too, but I think it is one of his masterpieces, and one of these days, everyone else is going to agree.